The spring of 1964 was supposed to belong to the Beatles. Britain was locked in full Beatlemania. The pop charts were a fortress of familiar faces, and the music industry on both sides of the Atlantic was running on a formula it trusted completely. Nobody in any boardroom, any radio station, any distribution warehouse was watching Jamaica. Nobody was betting on a 16-year-old girl from a sugar plantation parish who had never recorded outside of Kingston, had never lived outside of the Caribbean, and had only been in London for a matter of months. Nobody was ready for what she was carrying. But when my boy Lollipop hit British airwaves on April 7th, 1964, it did not ask permission. It didn't edge its way in. It landed fully formed, irresistible, infectious in the most literal sense, a melody that attached itself to the brain and refused to leave, delivered in a voice so high and bright and genuinely joyful that it sounded like nothing the pop world had manufactured before, because it hadn't been manufactured at all. It had been grown in Clarendon, sharpened in Kingston, and carried across an ocean by a girl who had been singing seriously since she was 9 years old. The song peaked at number 2 in both the United Kingdom and the United States. It sold over 7 million copies worldwide. It made Millicent Dawley May Small, Millie Small, the Caribbean's first international recording star. And it cracked open a door for Jamaican music that had never been opened before. Everything that followed, the rocksteady, the reggae, the dancehall, the global movement, the empire that would eventually carry Bob Marley to every corner of the planet, walked through that door. Millie Small kicked it open at 16, and the world never fully reckoned with what that cost her. Her birth year has never been definitively confirmed. The National Library of Jamaica records 1946. Other credible sources suggest 1947 or 1948. The exact year remains disputed across the historical record. What every source agrees on is that she was Millicent Dawley May Small, the youngest of 12 children, born in Clarendon, Jamaica, the daughter of a sugar plantation overseer. The sugar economy had shaped that part of the island for generations. It was not a world of glamour or opportunity. It was a world of hard soil, long labor, and quiet endurance. But even in that world, something in Millie Small could not stay still. She started taking an interest in music at 9 years old. By 12, she entered a talent contest in Kingston and won. The prize was $50 and a test recording. For a family like hers, $50 was not a small thing. For the music industry, what they had just awarded a prize to was not yet something they fully understood. She moved from Clarendon at 14, going first to live with an aunt in Kingston, then with her brother Franklin. She attended Cocoon Castle All-Age School. She was in Kingston at exactly the right moment, because Kingston in the early 1960s was electrically, dangerously alive. The sound system culture had taken over the dance halls, the yards, the street corners. Men like Clement Coxsackie Dodd, Duke Reed, and Prince Buster were building empires out of sound and rhythm and the loyalty of communities that lived for the weekend dance. Studio One, Dodd's label and recording operation on Brentford Road, had become the incubator for the island's finest talent, a place where the rhythms of mento, R&B, and American jazz were being fused into something new, something Jamaican, something that didn't have a clean name yet, but that audiences recognized the moment they heard it. That sound would eventually be called ska, a syncopated, upstroke-driven, high-energy rhythm that felt like a Caribbean answer to American R&B, louder and more joyful and utterly its own. Coxsackie heard Millie and stopped. Her voice had an uncanny resemblance to Shirley Goodman of the American R&B duo Shirley and Lee, a high, clarion tone naturally suited to a melodic style that most young Jamaican singers of the era couldn't access. He signed her immediately. He gave her the name Millie Small, placed her under the mentorship of Owen Gray, one of Studio One's established stars, and paired her on a duet called Sugar Plum in 1962 that became a genuine local hit. When Owen Gray's solo career pulled him in another direction, Coxsackie introduced Millie to another young singer, Samuel Augustus Panton, known professionally as Roy. As Roy and Millie, they became one of the most beloved vocal duos on the Jamaican scene, recording for Studio One and other producers including Lyndon Pottinger and Prince Buster. Their single We'll Meet sat at number one on the Jamaican charts for 6 weeks. That was not a footnote in a resume. That was a foundation, a demonstrated ability to connect with an audience that was one of the most discerning and demanding in the world. Somewhere in those sessions in the Studio One rhythm tracks, in the back and forth between singers and producers on Brentford Road, there is a small detail that nobody at the time could have foreseen mattered. A recording that Roy and Millie made together, that was shelved, never properly released, existing in the archive without fully reaching the audience it was made for. The Jamaican music industry of that era shelved things routinely, recorded them, sometimes lost them entirely. And that particular recording would sit quietly in the back of this story, unresolved, until the full cost of the industry's habits became clear. A 20-something English record man with a deep love of Jamaican music and a very clear vision was already paying attention. Chris Blackwell had founded Island Records in 1959, built around his genuine passion for the ska and bluebeat sounds he had grown up around in Jamaica. He had been licensing ska records to London's Melodisc label, testing the market with imports and small-run releases, watching the numbers, watching the audiences, calibrating what was possible. By July of 1963, he was convinced enough to move Island Records from Jamaica to London and make a direct assault on the British pop mainstream. He needed a voice, a vehicle, something that could carry the Jamaican sound into British ears without losing what made it Jamaican. He had heard Millie's recordings. He spoke to Coxsony Dodd. He made the case with the directness of a man who genuinely believed what he was saying, that he could build Millie a career, that no Jamaican label, with its limited reach and its captive island audience, ever could. In late 1963, Blackwell brought her to London. She was 16. She had never lived outside Jamaica. She crossed the Atlantic and landed in a country that had no frame of reference whatsoever for what she was, what she carried, or where she came from. The first single Blackwell made with her, Don't You Know, was a clean, professional slice of teen R&B that went absolutely nowhere. It landed and disappeared. That failure would have ended a lesser vision. Blackwell went back to his reel-to-reel collection, the stacks of American records he had brought from New York, cataloging sounds, cataloging possibilities. And there, buried in those tapes, was a 1956 recording by a teenage American singer named Barbie Gay. The song was called My Boy Lollipop, infectiously simple, a melody that was almost childlike in its directness. Blackwell heard it and heard Millie's voice on top of it simultaneously. He knew. He flew Ernest Ranglin to London. That decision was everything. Ranglin was not simply a guitarist. He was a musical architect, one of the most sophisticated musical minds Jamaica had produced, a man who understood the internal logic of Caribbean rhythm from the inside out. He took the old Barbie Gay recording, stripped out its American R&B structure, and rebuilt it with a ska pulse, that distinctive offbeat upstroke, the reverb-drenched treble guitar, the rhythm that lived in the space between the beats and made you feel it simultaneously in your chest and your feet. Ranglin stated that his entire intent was to shape the track into a ska tune, not a pop song with a ska flavor, but a genuine ska construction carried on the frame of a pop melody. The session came together in London with Ranglin at the center and Millie's voice doing what no session musician or studio engineer could manufacture. There is one detail from those sessions that has circulated for decades and has never been officially confirmed. The claim that a young, then unknown musician named Rod Stewart played harmonica on the recording. It appears across multiple accounts and has been repeated widely in the years since. However, it has never been verified by documentation grading above a disputed threshold. Consider it alleged until the record says otherwise. It may be true. It has simply never been proven. And it sits in this story the way unconfirmed things always sit. Quietly, with a weight that matters precisely because nobody has ever fully resolved it. My Boy Lollipop was released on April 7, 1964. On the back cover in Britain, Millie was billed as the Queen of Blue Beat. In the United States, the label called her the Blue Beat Girl. Two different countries, two different names for the same thing. A sound that had never reached them before, carried by a girl from Clarendon, whose family back home was telling anyone who would listen that their youngest was going to be a star. They were not wrong, but nobody, not even Blackwell, was quite prepared for what happened next. It exploded. In Britain, it climbed immediately to number 2 on the UK pop charts. In Ireland, it went to number 1. In America, it entered the Billboard Hot 100 on May 17, 1964 at position 90, and by June 28, it had climbed to number 2, held off the top position only by the Beach Boys' I Get Around. It spent 12 weeks on the Hot 100. It sold over 7 million copies worldwide. Chris Blackwell would later call it the most important song of his life, not simply a hit, but the financial and cultural engine that allowed Island Records to become what it eventually became. Without My Boy Lollipop, the argument goes, there is no Island Records empire. Without Island Records as a platform, Bob Marley's international trajectory looks very different. The threat is direct, and it is real. Millie Small was 16 years old. She appeared on Ready Steady Go in the UK, on the BBC, and on ABC TV's Shindig in the United States. She appeared on the Beatles' own 1964 television special, Around the Beatles. She made her film debut performing My Boy Lollipop in a British pop musical called Swinging UK. She toured with Patti LaBelle and Otis Redding as her opening acts, a lineup that speaks to the genuine commercial weight the industry, however briefly, placed behind her. British reggae broadcaster David Rodigan would later say that watching Millie Small perform on Ready Steady Go as a schoolboy was the precise moment that ignited his lifelong love of Jamaican music. That is the scale of the door she opened. But the pop machine of 1964 was not built for longevity. It was built for the chart cycle, for the immediate commercial return, for the next moment. Every major label scrambled to find their own Millie Small, another Caribbean voice, another ska-flavored novelty hit, another entry point into whatever this was. None of them found it. And in that scramble, what got quietly lost was the actual ongoing career of the girl who had started it all. The follow-up singles didn't match the seismic scale of My Boy Lollipop. The industry that had briefly placed her at the center of the global pop world moved on with the speed the pop world always moves, mercilessly and without acknowledgement. She kept working. She kept recording. She recorded with Jimmy Cliff in 1966, a duet called Hey Boy, Hey Girl, featured on the album Ska at the Jamaica Playboy Club, with a young Cliff whose own international rise was still ahead of him. The collaboration existed in that particular Jamaican music industry, way meaningful, documented, and yet never quite given the commercial push the talent inside it deserved. It was the kind of session the industry produced regularly in that era. Two major artists crossing paths at a moment when nobody was paying quite the right kind of attention to either of them. That underpromoted collaboration between Millie and the early Jimmy Cliff sits in the record quietly, much like the Roy and Millie recording shelved years earlier in Kingston. Two different moments, two different careers, the same industry habit, taking what it needed, not fully returning the investment. She toured. She carried a song that had sold 7 million copies and that the industry seemed to want her to perform indefinitely, while the rest of her artistry waited at a door that was not opening. That tension between the scale of what one record had done and the industry's unwillingness to build what came next is one of the oldest and most brutal dynamics in popular music. Millie Small did not invent that trap, but she lived inside it with more grace than it deserved. Then 1968 arrived, and Enoch Powell opened his mouth. The conservative MP's Rivers of Blood speech was a direct, apocalyptic assault on immigration and on the right of black and Caribbean communities to exist as full citizens in Britain. It detonated across the country. sending a shockwave through every Caribbean family who had come to England believing they had a right to be there. The speech made clear, viscerally, publicly, with the authority of a political platform, that there were powerful voices in British society that disagreed. The impact on Caribbean communities in London, Birmingham, and beyond was not abstract. It was immediate, personal, and frightening. Millie Small wrote back, co-written with her partner, German-born painter Eddie Wolfram. Enoch Power directly appropriated the politician's name and turned it into an anthem, warm, wry, defiant, built around the right of Caribbean and multicultural communities to belong, to stay, to be seen. The origin of the title carries its own small story. It was supposed to be called Enough Power, Millie later said, but my manager suggested I use Enoch Power. The BBC banned it immediately, which, as bans always do, only deepened its resonance with exactly the audience it was built for. She performed it at Wembley Stadium in 1970 at a landmark Caribbean music festival, and filmmaker Horace Ove included the performance in his documentary Reggae, cutting it directly against footage of Powell's speech, making the dialectic explicit and devastating. In that moment, Millie Small was not a pop relic. She was a cultural force, speaking directly into the ugliest political argument of her era, with a song that refused to look away. After a short period with President Records in the early 1970s, Millie Small stopped recording. She withdrew from the music industry almost completely, living quietly in London, giving very few interviews, staying out of the spotlight that had burned so brightly for such a short and concentrated time. The industry did not come looking for her. The machine that had used her singular moment to build its own fortune, most visibly Chris Blackwell's Island Records, which leveraged the commercial success of My Boy Lollipop to establish the financial foundation from which it signed and broke Bob Marley and the Wailers, among many others, moved forward without looking back at the girl who had made it possible. The question of what was owed to Millie Small, financially, professionally, culturally, never received a clean public answer. It lived in the 7 million copies sold, in every Jamaican act that followed her through the door she had opened, in the unconfirmed name in the recording session that nobody ever officially verified. Who was in that room? What they took from it? What she received in return? These questions sat in the record, unresolved, the way the industry always leaves them. She died on May 5th, 2020, in London, from a stroke. The announcement came from Chris Blackwell himself. At the 2012 London Olympics opening ceremony, My Boy Lollipop was played to an audience of billions. In sound systems from Kingston to London to Toronto to New York, her voice remains exactly what it always was, impossibly bright, rooted in the Clarendon soil that made her, carrying a joy that no industry calculation could ever manufacture or replace. She was Jamaica's first, not just the Caribbean's first international recording star. Jamaica's first proof, delivered at the highest possible volume, that what was being made on that island was worth the world's full attention. Everything that came after, the rocksteady, the roots reggae, the dancehall, the global cultural movement, walked through the door that Millie Small kicked open at an age that records disagree on, with a borrowed melody, a Jamaican beat, a guitar legend's offbeat upstroke, and a voice the world was completely unprepared for. She opened the world. She got very little of it in return, and the music remembered everything.